Today we're going to start talking about the Higgs boson, how it decays, how it's produced, what are its properties. It's kind of this remarkable thing that in order to have a massive gauge theory, we needed to introduce the Higgs, and it was discovered. It was predicted, and then it was discovered. It's kind of a triumph for theory. So now that it has been discovered, we want to measure all of its properties, because remember, the Standard Model is very predictive about all of the couplings of the Higgs boson. All of the couplings are always just proportional to the masses of those respective particles that the Higgs couples to. The only unknown parameter is just the mass of the Higgs itself, or equivalently lambda in the Higgs potential. But once we have discovered the Higgs mass, we've measured lambda, everything else can be predicted. Okay, so here's what we know. The mass of the Higgs is around 125 or 126 GeV. The couplings of the Higgs to Standard Model particles is proportional to mass, and so the heavier the mass of a given particle, the larger its coupling to the Higgs boson. The most massive couplings, or the largest couplings, are the Standard Model particles with the largest mass. Are the top quark, the W boson, and the Z. We know already what the masses of these particles are. So if these states were light enough, you'd expect most of the time the Higgs to decay to all of those, each of these states. But of course, it can't. It's kinematically forbidden. So Higgs decaying into TT bar, W plus, W minus, and ZZ are all kinematically forbidden. This means it's actually very fortuitous to us experimentally or phenomenologically, because we can measure lots of different things. If the Higgs was heavier than a few hundred GeV, the only thing we can measure would be those couplings. But because the Higgs mass is only 125 GeV, we can measure its decays to states that are the ones that are kinematically allowed. So we can measure the Higgs coupling to even lighter particles, such as bottom quarks or tau leptons, in addition to those couplings as well. So it's pretty fortuitous, in fact. So what we're going to talk about first are decays. And the simplest decays are the tree level decays. So we have the Higgs decaying into fermions. And so the interaction of the Higgs is just minus the mass divided by the VeV, Higgs field psi bar psi, where psi is any Standard Model fermion that's kinematically allowed. So anything except the top quark. So let's compute this process. So we have the Higgs decaying into two fermions, psi bar. So we'll call this momentum P, momentum P prime, momentum Q. And the Feynman rule is just minus I, the mass, divided by the VeV. So then the matrix element is minus I m psi over v u bar of p, v of p prime. And I'm going to neglect the masses of the fermions. I'm going to assume that m psi, or let's say twice m psi, is much, much less than the mass of the Higgs. So it's a reasonable approximation, even for the bottom quark. All right, so when you sum over spins, for the final states, and square the matrix element, you have m psi squared over v squared times 4 p dot p prime, which is equal to 2 m psi squared mh squared over the vev squared. Okay. So, of course, it's using the fact that q squared is mh squared is 2 p dot p prime in the limit that the fermions are massless. Okay, so then you can do the two-body phase space integral to compute the decay width. And it's 1 over 16 pi mh times the sum of the matrix element squared. And so this gives you m psi squared mh divided by 8 pi v squared. Okay, so that's the general formula. Now let's just plug in for the various fermions in the standard model. See what we get. So Higgs to tau tau. Okay, it's just m tau squared mh over 8 pi v squared. And this is around, if you just plug in numbers, 0.26 MeV. Higgs to BB bar is MB squared MH over 8 pi V squared. is that it? Do I need to fix it in any way? This is my excuse to get some coffee. What was the question? Okay. Is the formula correct for Higgs to BB bar?
But you have color.
We have color, yes. Thank you. Okay. Thank you. Okay. Okay, it's not too hard. All right, just multiply by 3 for color. All right, so when you plug in, this is 4.3 MeV with a footnote, so I'll tell you what that means in a second. And also Higgs to CC bar is, okay, the charm quarks also have color, MH over 8 pi V squared. And this is around 0.4 MeV. Also with a little bit of a footnote. The footnote is, it comes from the renormalization group evolution of the masses, or of the Yukawa couplings for the bottom and charm quark. Typically what is done is you fix the mass, or you sort of define the mass for these states at the energy scale of the mass itself. But then when you're talking about the Higgs decaying, you have to run that mass, or that Yukawa coupling, up to 125 GeV, it reduces the mass somewhat, okay? So if you just plug in the mass quoted in the PDG, you won't get exactly this answer because you need to take into account the normalization group evolution of the masses. So just to tell you what that means, so the normalization group evolution of MB, MC, or you can think of it as YB, YC, the Yukawa couplings, reduces MB and MC by a factor of around 2 for B and around 4 for the charm cork, since it has more to go. Okay, so in terms of percents, this ends up being around 6.3% of the total branching fraction. This one is 58%, and this is 2.9%. Okay. All right, so there's other tree level decays as well. So the other tree level decays are decays to the massive vector bosons, W plus and W minus, or Z, Z. And I already told you that this is not allowed, okay? But it is allowed if one of these states is off shell. So one of them could be a virtual vector boson, and then that could decay. And so you have a more complicated final state. So this is allowed if one or both vector bosons are off shell. And so the W mode is a little bit complicated experimentally, because typically in colliders, the cleanest signals are the ones involving leptons, all right? Because at the LHC, for example, when you collide protons together, it's easy to get lots of quarks, all right? And so in the case where the W's decay to quarks, it's hard to disentangle that it actually came from a Higgs. So the cleanest signals are the ones involving leptons, but of course, when the W decays to leptons, it will also decay to a neutrino, and you don't see the neutrino. So a little bit harder to constrain experimentally. Yeah?
Isn't the point also just that leptons don't hadronize? Jets are a mess to reconstruct.
They are complicated to reconstruct, but it's not hopeless.
I'm going to get a much cleaner signal if we're working with leptons.
So, no, that's not really the real problem. If you see a very high energy jet, that's also something that's fairly clean in the collider, although maybe it's not quite as clean as a very high energy lepton. That's not really the issue. The issue is that to disentangle this type of process, which is some physics that you're interested in, versus the strongly interacting physics, which you're not exactly interested in, unless you're interested in that. But most people aren't. So that's the problem. The problem is that if you observe jets from these states, it's actually much, much more likely that you observe jets with a similar energies that just came from QCD. OK, so the W is a little bit complicated to see the leptons from. Or I should say it's not complicated. It's just difficult, more challenging to reconstruct that it actually came from the Higgs, because some of the energy goes into the neutrinos. But for the Z, you're OK. So the most promising channel, or the best channel, you could say, is Higgs to ZZ, where one of them is off shell. They both could be off shell, but the dominant process is if just one is off shell. And this will decay into fermion pairs, psi psi bar and psi prime psi bar prime. OK, so of course the fermion pairs don't have to be the same. But there's the best mode for discovery is what's called the so-called golden mode. So this is Higgs to Z, Z star, which decays into 4 leptons. Leptons means E plus E minus, or mu plus mu minus. Typically, tau is not included in the quote-unquote definition of a lepton. Just because electrons and muons are much cleaner, taus are more complicated to see. So you can compute this. It's not so challenging, but it's a little tricky with all of the final state kinematics. And let me just write down what the branching rates are. So Higgs to Z star is around 0.11 MeV. And in terms of the total branching fraction, it's around 2.6%. And Higgs to W star is around 0.88 MeV, which is about 22% of the total branching fraction. OK, so those are the tree-level decays of interest. But there's also loop decays, which are very, very important, both for production and for detection. So these are very important. So one is Higgs going to glue, gluon pairs. And this ends up being around 0.35 MeV, which is around 8.8%. And the other one is Higgs to gamma-gamma, which is 6 times 10 to the minus 3 MeV, or 0.15% of the total branching fraction. So of course, the gluon and the photon don't have mass. They're massless. So how does the Higgs couple to them? It can at one loop order, when you consider virtual particles in the loop that are very heavy. So Higgs to gamma gamma is very rare, but experimentally very clean. This is the other golden mode. And when it was discovered, it was in Higgs to gamma gamma. So what we're going to compute is the easier process, which is Higgs to glue. So this one is easier to compute. But very difficult to measure. When you collide two protons together, it's easy to get lots of gluon jets coming out. And so it may, in fact, be impossible to measure two gluons that are coming from the decay of the Higgs. All right? But actually, this process is going to be very, very important for producing the Higgs boson. Protons have lots of gluons. I showed you a plot yesterday of the gluon PDF in the proton. And so it's very easy for two gluons to come together and fuse through an inverse decay to produce the Higgs boson. So although what we're going to compute is not really very interesting as far as searching for decays of the Higgs, it's very important for thinking about production of the Higgs. All right, so this is going to be our mission, to compute Higgs to glue. So here's the matrix element. There's two, so I'll call it M1 and M2. And here are the Feynman diagrams. So here's the Higgs. And then there's a one-loop diagram. The largest contribution will be when the state in the loop is the top quark, all right, for reasons that will become apparent once we have the final answer. So here's the top loop, this. And here's the gluons in the final state. So A and B will be the SU3 color indices in the adjoint representation. Mu and nu are the Lorentz indices. And then I should label the momenta. So here is momentum Q for the Higgs decaying. Call this P prime. And then the loop momentum will be K. And so this will be K. This is K plus Q. And this one will be K plus P prime. OK, and then there's one more diagram, just when I cross the gluon lines coming out. So here is G A mu, G B mu. And this. So this is P, this is P prime, and I also have the momentum in the loop as well. Let's see if I can write it down. So let's say this one is K. I guess let's just try this. K plus Q, and so I think this one has to be K plus P. Top of the loop. Okay. So the other thing to note is that Higgs can't decay to TT bar. And so you can't probe the Higgs top coupling by Higgs decaying to TT bar because it just isn't allowed. But when we can probe the decay or inverse decay of Higgs to glue glue, we're indirectly probing the top quark coupling to the Higgs. All right? So it's through these loop diagrams that you can probe the Higgs coupling to states that are even heavier than 125 GeV. OK, so so now what we're going to do is go through and compute these one-loop diagrams. And they both give the same answer. So they're both equal to one another. So we just have to compute one of them. So here we go. So I have a loop integral. So let me use dimreg in d dimensions. The whole thing is going to end up being finite. You have a question?
So why are you only considering the loop to be a top quark and not anything else?
Yeah, so in principle, I guess for the moment, you can suspend your disbelief and just say that it could be any fermion in the loop. In general, those fermions do contribute. As we'll see, only the most massive fermions will give the largest contributions. So ultimately, it's only going to be the top that's important. But if you want to...
The entire calculation.
Yeah, everything about the entire calculation is the same. Only the mass will be different for the others. All right, so we're going to be using dimreg. So I should put this in d dimensions. It's a little bit subtle what's going on here. The whole thing is going to end up being finite. But there's a little bit of a subtlety where you have to work in d dimensions and then be a little bit careful about how you take the limit that d goes to 4. So if you like, we're just regulating this, that subtlety, by putting it in dimreg here. All right, so I have minus 1 for a fermion loop. And then I have to do the trace over the fermion loop. And so I have some fermion propagators. So it's I k slash plus mt over k squared minus mt squared. I'll just omit the I epsilons. I gs tb gamma nu. So that's from the bottom index, bottom vertex of the triangle there. I have a I k slash plus p slash prime plus mt over k plus p prime squared plus, minus mt squared. I have I gs ta gamma mu I k slash plus q slash plus mt over k plus q squared minus mt squared. And then for the Higgs vertex, I have I mt over v. And that's the end of the fermion trace. And then I just need the polarization vectors for the gluons. So I have epsilon nu and epsilon nu. I think all the notation you're probably familiar with, maybe you forgot these t's, ta and tb, are the generators for SU3. So those are just the Gell-Mann matrices divided by 2. So let me just rewrite this in a slightly more simplified form. So I have minus gs squared. The trace here goes over not just the spinner indices, but the SU3 indices as well. So I should think of the trace over the gamma matrices and then also a separate trace over color inside the loop. Yeah?
Probably a really stupid question, but where exactly does the trace come from?
So the trace comes from the fermion loop.
Why does that give you a trace?
So each part of the fermion propagator is like a matrix in both color space and in spinner space, in Dirac index space. Okay? And so by going around the loop, you're multiplying all of those matrices together. And at the end, you get back to where you started. And so you need to contract the starting index into the final index, which is just taking the trace. So for the color part of the trace, the only part that carries color are these generators. So I should just write the trace of TBTA, or equivalently TATB, since I can just permute them cyclically. Then I have a coupling, which is MT over V. I have the polarization vectors, EMU and ENU. And then I have my loop integral, dk over 2 pi to the d. And then the trace of all of the Dirac matrix stuff, k slash plus mt gamma nu, k slash plus p slash prime plus mt gamma mu, and then k slash plus q slash plus mt, and that's it. And then it's divided by the denominator, which is k squared minus mt squared, k plus p prime squared minus mt squared, and then k plus q squared minus mt squared. Okay. All right, so hopefully you all remember all of the tricks for computing loop integrals. The first step is to simplify the denominator using Feynman parameters. So that means I have minus gs squared trace of ta tb mt over v epsilon mu, and then the Feynman parameters means I have to write down an integral over dx, dy, dz. There's one parameter for every factor in the denominator. And then I multiply by that number, which in this case is 3, minus 1 factorial. And so that's 2. And then I have delta of 1 minus x minus y minus z. I've got a trace of a bunch of stuff. And then divided by what was in the denominator, which now takes the following form. K squared minus mt squared x plus k plus p prime squared minus mt squared y plus k plus q squared minus mt squared z, and then that's all to the third power. Okay, so if you forget the rule, then you can just go to Peskin and Schroeder and remind yourself what the formula is and how this works. Oh, the integral over k, yeah, it should still be there. I forgot that. Thank you. Okay. The next step that you want to do is simplify the denominator. So remember, ultimately, we want to write this as an integral over shifted momenta, L. And so we need to rewrite this denominator into that sort of form, where we can perform the shift. So here's the term in brackets. It was k squared minus mt squared x plus k plus p prime squared minus mt squared y plus k plus q squared minus mt squared z. So if we expand everything out, we have k squared times x plus y plus z. Which is equal to 1, according to the delta function. There is a plus 2 times k dotted into yp prime for this term, and then plus zq for this term. Then there's a p prime squared times y, and this is just equal to 0 since the gluon is massless. Then there's a q squared times z, which is just equal to mh squared. And then lastly, there's minus mt squared x plus y plus z, and this is also equal to 1. Okay, so at the end of the day, can be written in the following way. K actually, let me just go through the steps. So let me just write out what this is. This is k squared plus 2k dot y k prime plus z q. And then I have plus mh squared z minus mt squared. The next trick is you want to complete the square. So I want to write it in terms of a shifted momentum squared. So I need to complete the square by adding and subtracting off the same term. So this is all equal to k plus yp prime plus zq quantity squared. So I have the k squared term. I have the cross term, which is right there. But now I need to complete the square by adding and subtracting off the following. So I've added this squared, so I need to subtract it off. So there's yp prime plus zq squared that I have to subtract off to complete the square. And then I have plus mh squared z minus mt squared. Okay. And this whole thing, I'm going to define as the shifted momentum L squared. So this is L squared. And then let me expand this term out. So the first term will be p prime squared is equal to 0. The second term squared will be q squared, which is mh squared times z squared. And then I'll have the cross term. So I'll have the following. Z squared mh squared plus mh squared z minus, or I should say plus mt squared. Then I have plus 2yz p prime dotted into q. I'm going to call this whole thing m squared, capital M squared.
Minus mt squared.
Is it? Could be. This one?
Yeah. And then?
And then the minus sign.
There's the minus.
Yeah, but the other one's plus. You have plus mh squared z minus mt.
Ah, right, 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 right. So one of these is wrong. I think, is it this one? Is that correct? It's important to get these things right, so you should mention it if I make a mistake. Otherwise, we're going to get the wrong answer. And we'll disprove a standard model Higgs instead of prove it. Okay. Okay, then the last thing I just want to plug in is I just want to know what is p prime dot q. So this is p prime dotted into p plus p prime. So p prime times p prime will be 0. And so this is just p dotted into p prime, which is 1 half q squared. And so that's 1 half mh squared. OK, so let's see what I have ultimately. So this factor is L squared minus m squared. And L squared minus, or let me just write it like this. So now what's m squared? M squared is equal to mt squared minus, let's see if I can do this. So I have plus z squared minus z times mh squared. And then this term is 2yz times mh squared. So the 2 will cancel the 1 half. And I'll just get yz mh squared. Ah, right, OK. So this is mt squared minus mh squared 1 minus y minus z times z. And so this quantity is x. the remaining Feynman parameter. So now we have the final result for m squared. It's mt squared minus zx mh squared. Okay, so that's the simplified form. And then lastly, L was the following: k plus y p prime plus z q. And so I could have also written that as k plus 1 minus x p prime plus z times p. Okay, so that just comes from setting q equal to p plus p prime and grouping the terms together. Okay, so that was the denominator. It's a little bit of algebra, but it's straightforward. What the logic is, you use Feynman parameters, and then you just try to simplify the terms. So now we have to talk about what the numerator is. So we had the trace of all this stuff. So here's the trace that I wanted to compute. I'll spare you the details of expanding it out, but you can do that, and here's what you get. So you get 16 times mt l mu l nu minus 4 l squared mt eta mu nu plus 4 mt squared mt cubed eta mu nu minus 2 mt mh squared times 1 minus 2xz eta mu nu plus 4 1 minus 4xz p1 nu p2 mu times mt. I think I have an extra mt factor floating around. Let's see where that came from. Oh no, I should have dimensions mass cubed, so I think I'm okay. Okay, so if you expand out what I wrote as the trace of all that stuff, this is what you get. Modulo some extra terms which I threw away. So I threw away that were proportional to p mu or p prime nu. All right, so we can throw those away because when you contract either of these two things into the respective polarization vectors epsilon, then you'll get zero. I also threw away some other terms. Which were linear in L. So these terms I can throw away because the denominator is quadratic in L. It only depends on L squared. And so in the numerator, if I have a term that's proportional to a single power of L or L cubed, that will be odd under the integral and will give me zero automatically. All right, so now I have to do a few more tricks. So in D dimensions, you can replace L mu, L nu by 1 over D, eta mu nu, L squared under the integral. And the reason that I get this factor of 1 over d is if I contract eta mu nu with eta mu nu, it's equal to d now instead of 4. Right, so if I just do eta mu nu times L mu L nu is equal to L squared, and so that's 1 over d times L squared. Okay, so these terms will cancel out. All right, so when we combine everything, this is minus g squared, the trace of TA TB. I have MT squared over V. So I have a factor of MT multiplying all the terms in the numerator, which are above. I have epsilon mu, epsilon nu. And then I have d dimensional integral over the momentum L. I have my Feynman parameter integral, dx, dy, dz, times 2 delta 1 minus x minus y minus z. And then I have 1 over L squared minus m squared cubed. And then I have to multiply by everything in the numerator, which takes the following form. I have 16 divided by d minus 4 L squared eta mu nu. And then I have plus 2 times 2 mt squared minus mh squared 1 minus 2xz times eta mu nu. And then lastly, I have 4 times 1 minus 4xz, p1 nu, p2 mu. OK, so it's still a little bit complicated. All right. So now we have to, now that we've simplified the numerator and the denominator, we've used the Feynman parametrization. We want to perform the integral over L, over this shifted momentum. So it's described how to do these loop integrals in Peskin and Schroeder, so I'm just going to borrow the formula for doing these momentum integrals. In using dim reg. So we have integral 1, which is d dl over 2 pi to the d l squared over l squared minus m squared. And the formula, I should say the answer, is minus I over 2 pi, 4 pi, d over 2 times d over 2 gamma 3 minus d over 2 minus 1 over gamma of 3 times 1 over m squared to the power 3 minus d over 2 minus 1. And then the other integral we have to do is d dimensional integral over 1 of 1 over l squared minus m squared cubed. And the formula for this is just I over 4 pi to the d over 2. Then I have gamma of 3 minus d over 2 over gamma of 3. And then 1 over m squared 3 minus d over 2. OK.
Are we dealing with real integrals? Did you get a complex result?
Will we get a complex result? I don't think we will.
No, there's an I on the right, and on the left, there's a real integral. No?
No, but the whole thing is multiplying a factor of I there on the left-hand side.
So 1 is not actually equal to that integral. It's I times that integral.
I should say the stuff appearing on the right will end up being imaginary.
No, like just the lower board.
Oh, the lower board.
There's
okay.
Something strange going on. You have an integral which is a real integral of
yeah.
Something real in real space. And
yeah,
it's
it ends up being imaginary. Doesn't it?
But how? It's an integral of a real space.
Yeah.
Of a real integral.
I don't exactly have a deep answer for your question, but it's complicated when you're integrating
you
over
just an I missing
but when
in
you
front of the
integral? Weak rotation?
Yeah, so it's an issue of dealing with like the Lorentzian signature of the metric. So you can imagine doing the Weak rotation, as you mentioned, and then you'll have an extra factor of I times a real integral over Euclidean space. So it's an issue with the Lorentzian signature of the metric that's giving this extra I, but I don't have a deep explanation where that comes from.
Even with Minkowski's signature, it's still squared, so it can be negative, but it's still real.
What about the factor of DDF? I mean the measure.
No, if I don't weak rotate, I can still do, like, it's an integral of a real space of a real integrand. It might be negative, but
what
it's real. What? I'm not asking how to do it, I'm just observing that it's real.
Yeah, so I don't have an answer. Let me continue on. I don't have an answer. It's hard for me to envision how it works with the Lorentzian signature. Euclidean signature, I would agree with your argument.
I'm not even talking about solving the integral. I'm just saying, like, you have a certain measure, and you look at the measure, you see it's real. You
mm-hmm.
look at the integrand, you see it's real. Then you know that the integral will be real.
Yeah, I guess I could make the same argument if I had a Euclidean signature instead of the Lorentzian signature, it has exactly the same expression. So I don't have a deep understanding for why one gives you something imaginary and one doesn't. Exercise the interested reader. Okay, then. Okay. All right, so let's see. So I want to just direct your attention to one thing. The reason that we had to work in d dimensions and be a little careful, you can see that this integral diverges, right? Because you'll end up getting gamma of 0 when you set d equal to 4. Okay, so that's a divergence in dim reg. But the whole thing multiplies this factor of 16 over d minus 4, which is something that goes to 0 when d is equal to 4. Okay. So that's the way in which we're going to get something finite, but we have to be careful so that we can see these divergences getting canceled against one another. Okay, so the only thing I really need to worry about in terms of keeping d dimensions as opposed to just 4 dimensions is what happens to the divergence. And so let's just think about what is the divergent part of these diagrams. Oh, I should just say, let me rephrase what I just said. Integral 1 will contain the divergent part plus a finite part. Actually, I don't even care about the finite part. It's only the divergent part which will contribute. Because the finite part of the integral when I multiply by this factor, 16 over d minus 4, will end up just vanishing. All right? So I only need to evaluate the finite part of integral 1. Integral 2, I need to keep the whole thing, and it's finite. So integral 1 will end up being minus I over 16 pi squared d over 2 times gamma of 4 minus d over 2 divided by 2 plus finite terms. So this whole thing is minus I over 16 pi squared d over 2. Let me write it as d over 4, I guess. And so remember, when you have gamma of epsilon, as epsilon goes to 0, I can write that as just 1 over epsilon. And so that's just 2 divided by 4 minus d. So this whole thing is minus I over 16 pi squared. Then I've got d over 2, and then 1 over 4 minus d, plus finite.
Are you claiming that gamma of x is 1 over x?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Okay.
Yeah, oh, I even have in my notes, so gamma of x is equal to 1 over x plus finite terms. Or x goes to 0. Okay, and integral 2 is just equal to I over 16 pi squared 1 over 2 m squared. So, okay, so I just need the finite part. It is finite, I should say. Okay, so almost done. I have I times m1 is minus I over 16 pi squared ds squared, the trace of ta tb. I have mt squared over v, epsilon mu, epsilon nu. I still have my Feynman parameter integrals. Let me use the delta function to eliminate the y. And I think nothing under the integral depends on y. And so I just need to do the integral now over x and z. So the integral takes the following form. I have dx from 0 to 1 and dz from 0 to 1 minus x. And then what I end up getting when I plug in the loop integrals is I have minus 4 times 4 minus d over d times 2 times d 4 minus d times 2 times mt squared minus xz mh squared times 8 mu nu. Then I have plus 4 mt squared minus 2 mh squared plus 4 xz mh squared, 8 mu nu. And then I have plus 4, 1 minus 4 xz p1 nu p2 mu times 1 over m squared. So a bunch of stuff cancels here. I get a factor of d, which will cancel the 4. The 4 minus d cancels the 4 minus d. This mt squared cancels this mt squared, because now I just have 4 mt squared, 4 mt squared times 8 mu nu. And then I can write it in a simplified form as follows. So this is minus I over 16 pi squared GS squared trace of TA TB MT squared over V epsilon mu P epsilon nu P prime Feynman integral dx from 0 to 1 dz from 0 to 1 minus x. And then I have 4p1 nu p2 mu minus 2mh squared eta mu nu. And then I have 1 minus 4xz over m squared, which is mt squared minus 4xz mh squared. No, there's no 4 here. Xz mh squared. Okay, so that's where we're going to leave off for now. And we're going to pick up with this after the weekend.